Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Self Storage Insight Podcast. I'm Ben Shirey, and today I'm joined by Greg Smith. And Greg, if you don't mind, maybe we'll just kind of jump into your background a little bit. How did you get started in self storage, and maybe where are you at in the industry today?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for having me on the podcast. It's a real honor. I got into self storage about 3 years ago, just passively. I thought it would be a good real estate investment to have. I came from the corporate world, working full-time in the commercial banking industry, and had the time to look under the hood on the way different commercial real estate investments work, like mobile home parks, underwriting apartment complex deals, self-storage. And the interesting thing part was when the environment was hot and heavy back in 2020, 21, banks would underwrite this stuff based on pro forma and would essentially set you up for like 18 months interest only. And that would carry you to what the appraiser's forecasted DSC was. So it's really wild times. Like, you could basically go and pick your number and the bank would figure out a way to get you what you needed.
Yeah.
But on the side, for about 10 years, I was investing in single family residential, duplexes, fourplexes. We got up to almost 20 units that were long-term holds. And I dabbled a little bit with like fix and flips. And I think we did two or three of those pretty successfully. And then I invested in some small LP investments in a multifamily down in Houston, Texas. But one day my wife came home and said, I want to buy a daycare with my sister.
Okay.
And just kind of not really thinking she would actually do it, I encouraged her to just write 10 letters to some of these single shingle places that were run out of homes near our old neighborhood. And she found one that was really attractive. It was about 5 minutes away from where we lived and super close to a light rail line in Charlotte. And putting my real estate hat on, I was like, shoot, this would be a great investment. It's 1.36 acres. They want to sell it for about half of what it's worth. And we really got an MBA and a family business. We sat down beforehand at the kitchen table and we're like, this is not about money. We're just going to have fun. But I really learned three critical lessons that I was able to parlay over into the self-storage business. Number one, you have to be there. When customer issues come up, like, you got to be Johnny on the spot. It's all about customer service. And then the other one is to minimize your HR, because full-time employees are just a real challenge to deal with. And for our two facilities, they're about 50,000 net leasable square feet.
Okay.
And I don't know what you would call my management style. I guess it's a hybrid, but I have all the phone calls forwarded to my cell. And I think we figured out that like 75% of tenants are going to go with the first facility that acknowledges them.
Right.
So if they show up and there's a note on the door, they're just going to keep going down the street in most scenarios.
Let me, if you don't mind, if I stop and just ask another question on that, then as far as with you getting phone calls for both facilities, how much of a factor does that into if they move into your facility or not? Because I've heard numbers, you know, the industry numbers that are put out anyway are like 80% of people are going to rent from one of the first two facilities they get a hold of, you know, whether that's via phone or whatever. Have you found that to be a big driver in move-ins as far as answering your phone, or has it not played a big role in it?
Oh, it's a huge part. So I've actually got a track phone with our second location, and 90% of the calls are spam.
Right.
But when you get that one prospect that bites the hook, so to speak, you really got to sell them.
Right.
And the way I pitch Lake Wylie Self Storage is that we're one of the few locally owned and operated. But one of the things we've really tried to do was to invest in the SEO and put in a strong technical capability for some of the younger tenants that are our age that don't necessarily want to deal with a full-time manager. They've got the ability to pull it up on their phone, take a 30-second look, make sure the website's legit, see the Google reviews, and give them the ability to go in, book, and pay through online, which is really what we're all shooting for, I think, as owners.
For sure. So you acquired the first facility in 2020, 2021, April, mm-hmm. 2021, I think you said. How long was it then till you found the second facility, and were they related at all?
Yeah. So the interesting part was on the second property, those guys were actually related and introduced to me through the owners of the first one.
Okay.
And I had successfully gone through a conventional refinance. So on the $2.35 million purchase, I had to come up with $450,000. And the way I did that was through a 1031 on a duplex that my wife and I had done pretty well on from an appreciation standpoint. And then we sold a fourplex. And with the combination of our home equity line of credit, which I highly encourage any new investor to get, it's a weapon in your pocket. The access to cheap powder mm-hmm. is very remarkable. So if you talk to some of the smaller banks in town, you can get a 90% loan to value. Some of the smaller banks will even give you 100% loan to value.
Okay.
And to make it clear, it's not like a cash out refinance because rates right now are ridiculous.
Right.
But it's essentially a $100,000 line or whatever your home would appraise at that you can draw on if you've got a really good investment that pops up.
Right. And that doesn't even have to be like businesses as far as you can pull across different asset classes in real estate, correct? Because I know there is some stipulations on some of those types of financing, not on all of them. I was just kind of curious what your take is on that one.
So for a home equity line of credit, you get it and it's set up for 10 years mm-hmm. and the bank doesn't really have, it's not really any of their business what you're right. using the money for.
You right. As long as your other home is valued at that with that equity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how you were able to utilize or to get the upfront money to purchase the second facility right. through. And then you utilize seller finance on the backside of that.
Right.
Okay. So when you went into seller finance, the how much due diligence do you do as far as acquiring a facility through seller finance? You know, did you have somebody else come in and do a study, a feasibility study, or look at the books for you, or did you do that yourself? How involved were you in that process?
So these guys were really good and they kept good records. One of the sellers was an attorney and was very okay. meticulous about the history of the property. The challenge thing was they did not use self-storage software.
Right.
So it was all tracked on spreadsheets.
Nice.
But fairly reliable. I know that some folks are probably reading numbers off bar napkins that are acquiring some of these mom and pop.
Yeah, I've facilities. Heard some horror stories about that for sure. As far as,
but yeah. Fortunately, they had integrity. I don't think the office manager had sticky fingers or was right. pocketing cash. But to be honest with you, I didn't really know what I was doing on the first one. I'm a big believer in operating off my gut and I'm a big picture guy, but mm-hmm. I don't think I even opened up one of the self-storage doors. I had no idea what a spring was. any of the deficiencies I would now look for.
Right.
But I found just from my single family residential investment career, the more questions you ask, it's kind of like the seller might get a bad feeling in their stomach mm-hmm. that you're going to nickel and dime them
right.
over the small stuff. So it's kind of one of those things where when you go in, I look at the big picture and I know this is a good investment just right. from where it's located and
yeah.
what and, the property's and, been doing.
Yeah. And it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit different even today than it was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, obviously because of interest rates. Seller finance mm-hmm. deals are sought after way harder because it's a more attractive deal. Usually you can come to better terms. You're not fighting with a, you know, whatever interest rate you may be getting if you're going through SBA or however you end up financing that facility. But so, you know, in 2021, it wouldn't have been as attractive, right? Interest rates were much lower, but it still is. There's a different negotiation that goes into trying to buy a deal that's seller finance versus going through a broker and you know, the traditional way. So to your point of asking less questions and trying not to lose those deals, they are a little bit more tipsy on if that makes, you know, if that makes sense. So as far as negotiating them though, no, you didn't run into any issues as far as, you know, the numbers were way off what they told you, anything like that.
So one of the things I did that I think was creative, I originally put it under contract with the 3 functional acres and an additional acre of raw dirt.
Okay.
I think that was at 2.25. And then at that point, I was like, I need a little bit more of this dirt. Because the acre is just not, there's not a whole lot you can do with it.
Right.
I mean, there you can make improvements on an acre, but you get a little bit better economies of scale if you can put it on two. So I went to the sellers and made the argument that if I was able to keep Kathy and justify our the old office manager, I would need that extra acre. And they were willing to sell that to me as well for another 100 grand.
Okay.
But well, they still think that 10 acres is a perfect fit for some type of multifamily, but it's been sitting there for sale for the last 3 years since I've owned it.
So as far as then maybe the pricing structure, as once you acquired the facilities, did you do any like immediate rate increases? How did you kind of play the price increase market there?
So I was super cautious. The way the facility was run is they basically had fixed prices for a 5x10. I think it was $50. A 10x10 was 75, and a 10x20 was 100.
Okay.
And they hadn't adjusted those prices in like 20 years.
Yeah.
And the average legacy tenant, I think, was around 10 years.
Wow.
And they were probably 90% full when I bought it. And most of the time, if you find a self-storage facility that's 100%, means they're not charging enough.
Right, for sure.
And one of the things I did was install LED lighting just to make it feel much more secure. And we put in some extra surveillance cameras and then just did some general lipstick on the pig stuff, like little landscaping on the front, put up some new signage, and did parking lot striping, just kind of minor things, and fixed up the doors. But I'll tell you what the really challenging thing is about this industry is finding a good handyman. Because working on those garage door springs, it's super dangerous.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not really a good handyman. So, but being very diligent about my time and just the 80-20 rule, stuff that I can outsource, I'm going to outsource.
Absolutely.
And just focus on doing what I'm good at, which is going out and building relationships with potential sellers.
So are you currently, as you're sitting in the market today, are you still looking for any additional facilities, or are you pretty content with the two for now?
I actually went and cold knocked on the door of a guy that owns, it's like 100-unit non-climate controlled facility, maybe 15 minutes away from us. He's 100% full though, and has a waiting list, so no intentions to sell.
Yeah.
There, but one of the things I find myself doing is just driving down the road. I got my real estate broker's license on. If I see a property I like, I'm going to knock on the door.
Yeah.
Because you just never know. It's all about timing.
Right, absolutely.
And a lot of the opportunities lie when you've got two or three partners that bought it 20 something years ago, and they're just ready to move on.
Yeah, looking to cash out.
Yeah.
For sure. Yep. Yeah, that's
so
awesome.
That's where the opportunity is. That's kind of how we found the second one. It was two guys that I think were in their 70s, but they were ready to part ways. And this property had really been passively run, and they didn't put a lot of money into it. So with that, you get a certain flavor of tenant,
right,
that comes into play. And you know, they're paying 50% market and haven't had rate bumps in 10 years. And I think it was passively managed, but that manager wasn't necessarily keeping the most diligent records. So we had probably 25 units that weren't accounted for.
Okay.
In the software. And they didn't even have software. It was just tracked on physical paper leases. So that is where I had to bring on a professional manager. Kevin Liebrick at My Storage Ops came in and helped us out in untangling that hairball. Did a phenomenal job. Big shout out to Kevin.
Okay.
If anybody has a kind of a messy scenario that they're in the process of acquiring, he's a great resource. But he helped us kind of account for all those units. It's an interesting property too, because there's a commercial piece to it where they actually lease out their front parking lot to the adjacent restaurant for like $450 a month.
Okay.
And then there's a 4,000 square foot warehouse that had a gymnastics tenant leasing out of it. And then a company that leases RVs. So if you wanted to take your family to the mountains or to the beach in an RV, Open Road RVs could help you out. And then they also sell used cars. So that one has a nice diversification with the commercial as well. But just talking about that commercial tenant in the warehouse, that in hindsight, we should have just evicted them when we bought it. But it was cash flow coming in, maybe $2,000 a month. And we're still trying to like get our arms around what are we really dealing with here? Like, what did we just buy?
Right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. So as far as like, did you end up introducing any rate increases on the storage units, or what
was your thought? On this one, it was professionally managed, and our manager ran it much differently than I would have.
Okay.
So he comes out the gate and just doubled rates.
Mm-hmm.
And it drove off a lot of the occupancy, because I think when we bought it, it was like 50% occupied.
Okay.
And that made it go down to like, I don't know, 40%. And then speaking of just the low cost tenant base, like you run into some fringy folks in there.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of things done that were a little bit more corporate than how I would have. So when I stepped back in after we let Kathy go, our old manager, like I just handled things a lot differently with some of the legacy customers. And a lot of the folks are probably in their 70s, 60s and 70s, and they don't want to pick up their phone and like use a QR code or book digital reservations and that kind of thing. So you really got to be there to help them. But I'm just kind of figuring it out as I go. I've been on the front lines for probably 6 months.
And I mean, there's so many different ways. You know, I talk to a bunch of different people, and it seems like a lot of them do price increases differently as far as, you know, raising a couple people's rents each month and then trying to spread that out versus drive out a bunch of people at once. But yeah, a lot of these big management companies and stuff, they'll come in and say, well, if we double everybody's rent and you're at 50% occupancy, but you drop to 40, you're making an extra 30% gross margin, right? So even though we're driving occupancy down, we're getting up to market rates really fast, and they're ruthless about it. And that's just, they play the game, they're there to make money. And so yeah, it can go a lot of different ways though. So let me ask you, I guess, what was, as far as of the upgrades that you've done to your facility, which ones have had the most impact, do you feel like, on the occupancy rates, as far as, you know, the LED lighting or the redo of the parking lots? What kind of has made the most impact where you spent money and seen an increase to the facility occupancy from that?
Well, I think the biggest part is just the sign frontage, getting the LED lit sign and getting as much eyes on it as possible to drive those leads. Because for the mom and pop owners like myself, you got to have some kind of cash flow coming in. I'm not the wealthy U-Haul family that can just put their set price that they're looking for, which is their strategy. They're not scared of vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're going to charge you $200 or whatever it is for 10 by 20. And if you don't want it, don't take it. So I kind of fall on the other side of that camp. But yeah, the LED lighting on the signs, and then just having a generally neat and clean facility, doing the weeding goes a long way, making sure there's no trash on the property, just ensuring that there's no riffraff going on. And we're very blessed, and there's not a lot of homeless people down here. I've heard stories of just nightmares of trying to deal with people living in your units. And
yeah, that's actually not that uncommon. Like, a lot of people that I've talked to have had that happen in their facility, as far as trying to get people to move out and dealing with that kind of stuff. So it happens a decent amount, a lot more than I originally thought it would when I first involved in storage. So do you have any advice you'd give for somebody that may be interested in looking into getting into storage, but they're not invested yet in self-storage? Like one piece of advice you'd give for somebody looking to start out?
Absolutely. And there's all different types of levels of risk tolerance that people have. But my first advice would be to look at getting your house in order with regards to access to capital. And I hit on the home equity line of credit earlier. It's the best source of cheap powder that you've got. And my suggestion too would be to network as much as possible with brokers, with bankers, with people that are going to give you deal flow. Yeah, my suggestion would be another way to do it, if you just want to dip your toe in the water, invest in a limited partnership. Find a group that's going out buying $1 million mom and pop kind of deal and front them 25K or 50K just to get a feel for it.
Yeah.
And you'll get to see kind of how the sausage is made in the back as they go in and start to do the improvements on the property. And you'll just learn a tremendous amount for a relatively low cost.
Hey man, I enjoyed the conversation and having you on and kind of hearing your story and how you got into storage. And thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Self Storage Insight Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Just a quick reminder, this episode was brought to you by CC Storage. CC Storage is a no-cost property management software that allows you to pass the fees for credit card processing onto your tenants, freeing up some CapEx space for your business and helping you more efficiently run your storage facility. If you'd like to learn more about CC Storage, click the link in the description below, and we hope to see you again for our next episode.